and support. So let's start.
You need some time and multiple
places. Anything about the
What I intended to do was to look up the locals that were in, but I don't think that it was necessary. It's really necessary. Mm-hmm. If any more militant locals can be good, and it didn't last too long.
Well,
really.
What's the purpose exactly? How
was
it supposed
to be? It was, instead of calling it a labor party, they wanted to launch a labor party in Michigan in the heart of the auto industry. And instead of calling it a labor party, they thought that it might be more palatable if we called it Michigan Commonwealth Federation after the Canadian Commonwealth Federation, which was a labor party. And everybody understood that, you know, that that was for the working people, working men. And so we just named it the Michigan Commonwealth Federation.
Now, who actually formed it then?
Well, Emil Macy would have been one of the prime movers in that. And a Jewish president, probably the only one that I ever knew, Silvers. I can't think of his first name right now. Silvers. Was very active in it. And Hughes. And again, I'm lost on the first name.
It was primarily SWP people, though?
No, it was a coalition. Emil Macy was never in the SWP. He went from the Proletarian Party in the early days to the SP. And I think he always remained, unlike the Roosters, mm-hmm. I think he always remained connected to one degree or another.
Mm-hmm.
They never had too much control over them, you know, after they got that type of position, such a big union and so much influence, they never had too much control over them.
Well, was it the locals then that were the most, the militant locals that were the ones
yes.
involved in it?
Yes. Local 212 was the local in which I was operating at the time, working and operating. And so that's how I came into it. And Emil must have been just before he went off to the Army, I believe, before he was drafted.
Mm. And the goal was to actually run candidates as a Labor Party, basically?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Instead of calling it the Labor Party there in Detroit, it was so close to, you know, the Canadian Commonwealth Federation in Canada, that they thought that it would be a very close act of sort of brotherhood, the Canadian brothers and the brothers over on our side. And we had hoped that from the Michigan Commonwealth Federation that there would be others, other sections of the labor movement who, too, were a little bit afraid of saying labor, socialists, or anything like that, that they might form a Commonwealth Federation in their state, you know, Illinois, Ohio. But we were dreaming because it was it didn't last very long. It didn't have a very long life. And I couldn't give you any idea, but I don't remember participating in it any more than about 6 months.
Mm.
Several meetings where we just threw our whole energies into it. And it just didn't gel.
Well, in that case, what would happen?
Because
your whole SWP group that became involved,
well,
it was primarily
through the local. No, the SWP was still an independent political entity of its own, running its own candidates. So those of us who were very active and in the forefront of the labor movement, Bud Wheel, one of our people over there, participated, and Briggs, and Chrysler, and Dodge. But outside of that, no, we did not dominate it even. We were working, we were, you know, those who were in the labor mm-hmm. movement. And I really, SWP had a position that they were for a labor party. So they had to take the position that they would help to form mm-hmm. something like that. But not the whole movement, not the whole SWP was thrown into it.
Now, at that point, both you and Saul were working in Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He was in 47, he was at Chevrolet. In Detroit, was he? Where was he working?
He was working at Motor Products, which was a factory producing wheel rims and truck rims and several other things. It happened to be right beside the Big Mac Avenue plant, a big corporation, too.
So both of your political activities, so both of you were through the UAW local.
Mm-hmm.
Was he in the same local as you were
then? No. It was a separate local, huh? Motor Products local.
Did you ever end up running candidates on the Michigan Commonwealth or ever got that far?
I don't think we ever got that far. In fact, I'm sure we didn't.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that'll really kind of set that period. Then what we established last time was that in 40...
Well, I have on this one, 1946, that we were back there.
Uh-huh. He went back first.
Yes, he went back first. Mm-hmm.
And then...
And I continued working in... this is the period when the factories threw the women out without ceremony whatsoever. Women who whose husbands were still in the army, you know. And they were relieved and glad to get rid of the problems because in some of the militant places, women really played quite a role in maintaining the union as it was. For instance, in Briggs Local 212, the women there were in the forefront of the strikes. You know, we led the whole plants, the whole Briggs, all of the plants, 18,000 workers out on strike. The women did this at times. And... after they became educated, these women, especially the Polish and the Hungarian, they realized how hard their husbands and fathers had struggled to build a union. And it was an evident attempt all the way through this period. Once they got rid of, drafted these militant unionists like Emil Mazin mm-hmm. and Jess Peraza in 212, then that was a real attempt to break the union. They wanted to get that union down to where they could handle it before these men came back out of service and had the right mm-hmm. through their veterans' rights to get back in there. So,
so that's what even went into that cotton.
Went into the little cotton. I can't remember. It was for upholstery of seats and mm-hmm. cars. And I was in there just a short time, and it was very, very difficult. It was back-breaking, and it was the wrong kind of a place with me, with my one lung. It was terribly bad on me. And I just about died, but I had to keep, the family going. And Saul went up to Flint to look for work, but primarily to organize a branch of the Socialist Workers' Party up there. And so I was in Detroit until he found the place mm-hmm. and we could come up and get settled there.
So then he resettled in prison about 46.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he began this working with American Committee for European
Workers Relief. Mm-hmm.
Do you recall how that got going?
I don't recall exactly. I think that came from New York. I think it was a group of organizations that organized it. And I know that the SWP was part, it was a group of radicals, I believe, that wanted to help militants and radicals over there who were being suffering very much. And so we got the word, I believe, through the SWP or some branch of it. And when we got the names, we checked on them immediately. And we threw ourselves into it because we never realized until we got personal letters just how people were suffering. Never through the press did you ever get the letters that, a child was dying and there was no medicine and the mother had been raped and her jewelry had been taken off from her fingers and trying to keep her children together without a roof over her head, without anything. And her husband was a Jew and in the concentration camp. And when we first got these letters, we were just, galvanizing the activity. And we collected pots and pans and clothing and electric iron, just everything we thought that they would need, everything, towels and food. And when we got all of these things collected, and we did a good job of going around asking people and even some little stores, we didn't have the money for the postage. It was prohibitive. So then we had to have, time out and raise the money for postage, and as soon as that was off, these huge, great big boxes, another one would be ready to be sent.
Now, where would the names come from? Would it come from the central office in New York then?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we took primarily one family. We had two assigned to us, but they could never find another trace of the woman. And We took one family, and it was quite all that we could handle there and do it up properly. The family was the Santon family, and it was the daughter of a man by the name of Snevliet. We would say it in English, Snevliet, I think, in Holland. And he was the Eugene Victor Debs of Holland. He was the organizer of the railroad workers, and he had been taken to the camp and shot, along with seven others, for organizing the demonstration against the deportation of the Dutch Jews. And they had him on a list, naturally, for that. And it was his daughter who was left, and who had married a Jew. And the Jew was a husband, and his whole family was sent to the concentration camp. His whole family was exterminated. He happened to just be released because the Americans came in. And so she had already lost her father, and her mother was in the concentration camp, and had these three children just trying to keep them together without any place to go, no place to stay. And we had such sympathy for those people through her.
Now, were most of these people on the list, were they just radicals in general, or were they involved in organizations that were part of the Fourth International Order?
I can't tell you that. I really can't. Because, you see, we were very active in the union movement in Flint.
Mm-hmm.
And the men in the union that were in the shops at the time were so concerned with their union problems that this activity primarily fell upon the women there in
mm-hmm.
Flint, and particularly on me, because I was more organized and I was not afraid to go out and ask people for everything and anything. And so the women were the ones that were very involved in that. I don't know. I can't tell you that. We were more concerned with the union problems when it came to discussing, you know, what's going to happen and where did this action come from and so on, than we were after we got the name and the family made contact. This was just an intense activity. But I can't tell you too much. That you'd have to research out, I think.
In terms of your, after you left Detroit, was there an active decision on your part to not pursue your political activity through the unions any longer, or was it kind of happenstance the way it developed? That
well, they were not hiring women back. They would take their names, and I was blacklisted in Flint to begin with, and I certainly was blacklisted in Detroit. If I ever got back in a plant in Detroit after having done headlines in the paper, you know, the record that Briggs had on me and Bud Wheel, it would have been a miracle. No, I could never have gotten back. If the union leaders who had originally been the militants were all coming back from the army, you know, Emil Macy was not back at that time. He was in Okinawa. And if they'd all been back at one time and had the organization back under control again, we might have been able to do something about that question. But you see, Sherna, this is one thing that's always interested me. Really, basically, the most militant men in the union and the most revolutionary men in the revolutionary organizations were not too concerned about women's rights, either to work or to advance herself in any way. They just felt that they had much more important problems to solve. And if you solve the problem of a decent living for the man in the shop, that was good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't going to, you know, they weren't going to take up any questions of fighting for women to get back in the shop. And I would have preferred to have had it done on the basis of all women that were discharged than just to pick out one or two instances.
But you never thought about trying to work within the union, say, in an education capacity or something like that, because from this period on is when you become involved more in community-based organizations rather than industrial.
I think it would have been very, very hard for any union to have hired me. I had a reputation like a red flag waving all over the place. And I did do a lot of educating, but it was always and going into these small groups that we had organized through the party.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of that, no, I wasn't able to. I wouldn't have been able to go in as an educator or even to teach public speaking.
Mm.
It would have been very difficult because so many rank and file people were terribly afraid of red, and to have a woman red, I was something that was just abnormal, completely abnormal. This was rank and file, the way they looked upon a woman that would be political and be able to do things that they didn't have the, you know, the guts to do. So, no, that wouldn't have been possible.
After you moved back then...
No, it was about 3 weeks after that that this terrible accident happened.
Oh, after you... Right after you moved back? Mm-hmm,
just a short time after.
I see.
Uh-huh. And my youngest son lived 14 hours, and the other one then went into a terrible condition, and it took him 4 years. He went into a aggravated form of multiple sclerosis, and 4 years of absolute... you wouldn't believe it was a nightmare. But that was when all of that happened.
And so it was as you were recovering from the shock of the accident that you then became involved in the Unitarian work and the NAACP seemed to be your next kind of thrust.
The NAACP. I was a member of that before I left, but that's when we really got active because we were able to show... I was a member before. But we were able to, oh, Sherman, you'd like to meet the man who's coming here for the convention, yes. This is a man who graduated from Wilberforce University and had to go to work in the factory to make money, and so he did not dare to tell them that he was an educated nigger, you know. And he always kept it quiet that he was such a talented man. But we were working together in the NAACP with one of these accepted downtown black men, you know, an attorney who always consulted with downtown. They called him the downtown boys. And at one point, I became very, very discouraged with the president we had, so I turned to Edgar Holt and asked him, if I organize a caucus, will you run for president? And he said, yes, I'm not much of a man to promote myself, but I will. And from that day on, I'm telling you, as far as civil rights in Flint was concerned, everything changed. We elected him. And I had, you know, done a work long enough so that I could convince a lot of people that this was the man who would do the job. And he did. And he had no fears. And it was very, it took a lot of courage at that time for blacks to do what he did.
At that point, what was the membership in the NAACP? How many whites were involved?
Oh, probably, the whites, there might have been 5 or 6 whites. All the rest were blacks. And of those 5 or 6, they were all political. And I think they were all members of or associated with the Communist Party, with the exception of myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the only member of our group that was working in there, of the Socialist Workers' Party. But I had, I always seemed to know how to express their needs best. And I was always active in planning demonstrations, which was needed then. I mean, public demonstrations.
What was the main thrust of the activity at the time?
Main thrust of the activity was to open up the restaurants so that people could go biracially, eat together. And there was a skating rink that young people wanted, young black kids wanted to get into very, very badly. There was discrimination in golf club courses and all of these places, but we picked our targets one after another. And then in one case of police brutality, we decided we needed to really protest so the whole world could hear us because the police were just so immune, so deaf to everything that we were trying to tell them. And we put up a picket line around City Hall, and that was for 6 weeks. Now, in this case, again, the NAACP was new, newly militant, rather, I should say, and it was building its membership, and the police very often would say to them, oh, but you've got so-and-so in your ring, so you know who she is, or you've got this attorney, he's the only attorney that we had, really, who would go in and fight the way he did. He's a member of the Communist, or associated with the Communist Party, and so when the picket line occurred, we decided it would be best if I didn't come out and walk on the picket line, but I put out the Daily Bulletin's picket line. and I organized for the coffee and donuts and things like that. This is when the new City Hall was just built, and Nixon, Richard Nixon, was coming in to dedicate it, and it was quite a source of embarrassment because there were such persons as who was this Vincent Price who came to visit the new City Hall, and some cowboy glamour movie star. I don't know who he was, but it was an embarrassment to Flint because they'd have to go through this picket line. All blacks with their signs every single day, and it was so cold, so bitter cold. You can tell that these people had something to gain or they wouldn't have stayed out there during that kind of weather. And then it came turn for Nixon to come and dedicate it. And the Postmaster General at the time was a man by the name of Summerfield, and he was from Flint, Michigan. And so he called up the mayor of the city and the council members and said, "For God's sake, you've got to get that picket line off of that, out of the entrance of the city hall." And so they made an agreement, which they did not keep, that they would go into having some kind of an investigation of police brutality. It would be a public thing and so on. And they got the picket line off, and in good faith, you know, they thought something was going to be done. Another time, when we were trying to get fair employment practices in Flint, an ordinance, we decided to have a funeral ceremony. And there were about, I think there were about 300 or 400 people, blacks, that marched all the way through that city and reached that one main, the long main street. And from the north end all the way down to the center of the city, and we had a bridge in the center of the city with the Flint River running out. We had a hearse. And we had a casket, and we had a minister, or somebody who posed as a minister, with all with white gloves. And we had the casket was taken out, and we had the burial of the promises of the city commission for a fair employment practice ordinance.
Is this
your idea? Well, part of it. And we threw it over the bridge into the river. And of course, and they had a big, long sermon, and a big audience in the middle of the street. We did many things like that because we had to.
Before or after the picketing of the City Hall?
Aye, aye, aye. That must have been after.
Because the picketing of the City Hall, it seems like when you're talking today, was pinned down to about 1952.
1952?
Well, I was wondering if you recalled what some of the earlier activities were in the NAACP.
Well, you see, for this first period, when I had all of this terrible, terrible tragedy, I went to meetings and would put forth proposals and so on, but because of the presidency and the control of the organization, which had been under the control of the same people for, well, since its inception, there wasn't a whole lot done until Edgar Holt was elected the president, and we elected, of course, a board that went along with him. And I was on the board. I was elected to the board. I was a board member from the time he was elected all the way through until he left. No, I don't recall when that would be. I'll have to ask Edgar. He has a much better memory for things like this because he's remained in that one field.
Now, were you the only white on the board or were there several others?
No, there was this white attorney. And I believe that there was one other white woman. A Communist Party woman. I can't remember any more than that. All the rest of them are black.
Now, when we were talking the other day in Outline and stuff, it seemed we were talking about the classes that the FWP held and being in an interracial neighborhood and they're living in an interracial neighborhood right on the border.
We had a hall. We rented a great big hall. And it, in the back, it had a little separate room where we had a bar. And we were not permitted to sell drinks, but we could serve drinks, and people could donate to the organization if they wanted to. And every Saturday night, it was the only place in this city, and this was for quite some time. Here again, I wish that I had asked Sal how long it was. It must have been 3 years running at least. Every single Saturday night, we had a great big social evening, and the blacks usually provided the entertainment, almost always. The bands, the vocalists, the instrumentalists, and even some that had been in vaudeville a long time ago, they would tell jokes, and they'd have them bring their own mics and master ceremonies and so on. It was always very interesting and very good stuff, that the entertainment that we had, and everybody knew that. And we had dancing, interracial dancing, and some of them would like to sit down in the tables, you know, and drink and just talk, or perhaps play cards. I don't remember. They were playing some kind of games, not for money, but there were always people who wanted to, you know, come down on Saturday night just to see their friends and to enjoy themselves. And it was a big lot of work, you know, opening that hall and then cleaning it out afterwards. But it became quite an institution. And the police would like to have raided us. Oh, they would do anything in the world. And one night, we feel that there was a plant that came in. And he was smart enough to ask for change. Instead of a donation, he was smart enough to ask for change. And this meant that we were setting a price on it, which would meant selling for the beer that he ordered. And, of course, he went right out and got the police right away. And one of the most beautiful things that happened was we were a little concerned. We didn't want it shut down, and yet we expected it practically from week to week that it was going to be shut down on one pretext or another, or someone would set fire to it or throw a bomb in it or something. And this one particular night, by the time the police arrived, people from all over, and particularly the blacks, just came out of their houses. They passed the word around quietly. And I remember one very large lady still had her house slippers on and an apron, I think it was, and just came out of her houses and just sat around on a big porch. It was a big porch with high columns in front of this building. And they were talking to each other and just asked to say in their quiet, quiet way, there might be trouble, you know, if you press this too far. And then after the police left, they said, well, you know, don't ever let it happen again. We're going to close this place down. After the police left, I noticed that there was a group of people that said to the man who had made the complaint, a black man, we want to talk to you. And he said, I don't have time. I'm going somewhere else. And they said, we'd like to talk to you. And they just grabbed hold of his arms and took him down the block. So we knew that they appreciated having us there. And we were right on the edge of the white section of Flint, and the other, and across the street was the black section.
Now, were any members of the SWC black? Did you get black membership through the Social Security?
Well, you make contact with them. I know most of our black people came from the union movement. Mm-hmm. It solidified and cemented the relationships that we had. They got to know us as people that were, you know, very close to them because they could socialize, they could do serious things together and operating in the union together. Yes, we did have several black members of the SWP at that time. And influential.
From the neighborhood kind of stuff.
Well, they lived not too far from there. Yes, they lived in that south end section of the black community. And they were very proud, you know. In fact, one of the leading blacks of the city came down. We invited him, Dr. Leach, and he was a real Uncle Tom most of the time. But we thought that he had also heard about all this. Mm-hmm. We thought we would like to have him come down because he could rabble-rouse if he was turned down about certain issues. And there were some issues that came up, and we took a position on it, and we did something. And he was pleased, so we invited him to come down and speak. And this man came down, he started out with a sort of a religious speech about how good it was for people to come together and the whole business about how the races got, in the Bible, biblical times got separated and so on. And he spawned out shortly. He had a whole little pad of notes, a little paper. And he found out that he wasn't getting any reaction from this group. And it was a packed hall that night. And so he just shoved the papers aside, and he started really going to town. And the more he talked, the more response he got. You know, the old type of church, the more radical he got. And then afterwards, I think he was a little bit worried. He said, I hope nobody had a tape recorder. Well, we were too poor for such things then. I hope nobody had a tape recorder going. Oh, boy. It was wonderful going into those Negro churches. We called them Negroes, and that was before the word black was... If you called them black, then they wouldn't have liked it at all. And when after the strike, the only black sit-downer, Van Zandt. Did I tell you that before? Maybe I did.
I think so, yeah.
Where they hallelujah, and then, yeah. Oh, it was wonderful. Well, most of our NAACP meetings, until we decided we wanted to take them out of the church, we thought we were at that point then, and we met in a hall regularly in the same place. But before then, most of our NAACP meetings were in the churches.
Mm-hmm.
And they would either have the ministers come in and say a few words to us, and of course they always wanted to recruit for their churches, and they were really old-time religion. So
let's backtrack a little bit, because NAACP work is continuous.
Yes.
But the earlier, tell me a little bit about the kind of work that you were doing in the Unitarian Church, and then we could talk about the...
The Unitarian Church was quite a unique group of people there, and they were liberals, but they were courageous liberals. They weren't just the kind that, mouthed phrases. And I had a lot of respect for some of them, and they kept inviting me continuously to come to the church. And I wasn't about to go back to church after my experience during the strike with the church or any. I wasn't religious. Mm-hmm. And so one time, I said, I'll go over to the church and listen just once, because it was some issue that everybody was frightened to speak out on, and this Unitarian minister, John Morgan, was speaking about it. So when he gave his sermon that day, I was very impressed with the whole ceremony. It was so simple. And the church itself really wasn't church by this time. They had taken the cross off. It was formerly another church, taken the cross off the top of the building. They had taken the lectern, the Bible, everything, cleared it away. And we had a little mobile that had the Mohammedan symbol, Muslim symbol, and the Star of David, and, all together, and the cross all floating around. So I went over, and his sermon was so to the point and so heartfelt that I got carried away, and I started to applaud. And then I realized, oh, you don't do that. I was the only one applauding. And then I realized, you don't do that. I had been away for so long. And after that, he came up, and he said, you don't know how much good that did me. And he said, in the old churches, they used to have an amen corner, and he said that would help a man who was putting his ideas across the congregation to know if he is giving a good sermon or a bad sermon. And he asked if he might come over to the house to talk to me. And so he came over. And I said, but you don't understand, you're just wasting your time. When he came over to my house, I wouldn't mind cooperating wherever I can with you, but I am an atheist. And I'm a person who's not afraid to say that. I am an atheist. And he said, oh, listen, you've got more religion in your little finger than most of the people who fill up my church or any other church. He said, I've already checked you out, and I've heard all about you. And in the discussion, he had entirely different concept of religion, and it was a new one, and one that's valid. It's a matter of terms very often. It wasn't any of the orthodoxy, or it wasn't based on any book or publication or so on. So I was quite impressed, and after a few more discussions to make sure he knew where I stood, I agreed that I would come over and work, because I felt that I could work on some of the people to advantage.
What sort of work was it that he was interested in seeing done, or that you thought you could do there?
Well, it wasn't until I got into the church and looked the situation over to know how I could operate, because they were connecting up then, and it was a very important thing for that city. We had never had a college in that town until the University of Michigan came in and put an extension college in there, extension of the University of Michigan. And we were connecting up with that junior college that was there on the campus and the University of Michigan Extension with those people. We needed that in Flint. Flint was a factory town, a dead end of everything intellectually. And so we were getting a lot of those people, those professors. And I didn't want to, there are a way to bring people around to realizing what's needed in a factory town. And I wanted to work with him on that project. and one of the best that we had, a man came into town, a black professor by the name of Rogers, Delbert Rogers, and we were at the board meeting of the Unitarian Church, and he was a character anyway, and he had mentioned several books that he had read, and black literature, and nobody had read them. And he mentioned then a book written by E. Franklin Frazier called The Black Bourgeoisie. And I said, oh, I said, it's just wonderful. I just got it out of the library, but it's the first, I was the first borrower. And he said, you're kidding me. You're kidding me. What library? And it was a public library. They happened to have two copies of it. He had the other one when it first came in, and I had the other one. So we struck up a great friendship, and he became part of the NAACP activities to elect Edgar Holt part of the caucus. And he couldn't run himself for president, but he said, you make the spitballs, and I'll throw them. And he was a great orator, a great orator. And we're still very, very good friends. And so Dr. Rogers worked with me when I was around, when I got to know him better. And we said, we've got to have something in the way of current events. It's all right for the minister to take a topic. And by the way, we had then another type of existentialist as a minister. The first one was a follower of a Sartre, mm-hmm. and this one is a Camus, a follower. Mm-hmm. And he was just a little bit more esoteric, a little bit more mystic, I think. He was a fine man, born in Holland, and learned to speak English because of the war, and he was in a closet. So he was a beautiful man, but he always made things, left it out there in the realm of no positive solution. And by this time, I decided, well, he's not a John Morgan that can come in and punch the button. And Roger and I discussed it, and so I took on the responsibility of organizing a current events class before the sermon. And this was in another room of the church, and it soon got so big that people couldn't even get in the room. And as a result, two of the biggest contributors threatened that if I didn't, that wasn't thrown out of the church, and that thing just continued, they were going to leave the church, and they did.
What happened? Did the whole group
read
something and then discuss it?
No, we had, yes. For instance, one of the speakers that I called in, we even had the mayor of the city who was a Catholic and could not come to speak in our church, but as this current event class, and then, of course, the questions that came from our people made it intensely interesting because you would have a mayor and these people who knew what should be done and applying the questions. And so one of the speakers that I brought in was the same Edgar Holt, who was a radical speaker. Oh, my God. He came in, and he started off his speech with, thank God the Soviet Union put the Sputnik up in the sky the other day. That ought to date it. The Sputnik the other day instead of the United States. Because it proves to the world that the Soviet Union, without not having any racial discrimination, is able to, you know, do these things, and here we had never used our black brains. Well, anyway, he was a black militant, and he shocked the wits out of some of those, really frightened some of those people. But they loved him, too.
Was there an intermeshing or overlap between Princess Unitarian Church activity and the NAACP?
Yes. Well, my group in the Unitarian Church was also my group in the NAACP. The only reason that I say my group, that sounds like it's an awfully egotistical thing, but see, Dr. Rogers couldn't stick his neck out too far. I had to be the one in front, and whatever I proposed, he would find a way to fit in or back me up. And Edgar Holt, at the time, was not one who could campaign for himself. He could go down and raise holy hell, you know, and the police station, and finally, the word got out, don't touch Edgar Holt if he's out on something. That means we're going to have another big demonstration or something. But I was sort of the group that held that, you know, sort of brought them together and held them together. Edgar was a Baptist. He felt that he had to be with his people. And Rogers was a Unitarian. So, that yes, they were overlapping.
Now, at the same time, you were always involved in the SWP as well.
Mm-hmm.
him in, I mean, this is probably a little bit preceding it, when he ran for Senate in 48.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall anything about that, or the kind of speaking he did, where he went to speak, how it was all viewed? That would be the same time that there was the Wallace campaign.
My running for the Senate in Michigan was very difficult for me, but I didn't do a whole lot of speaking except just to whatever groups would, I can't even remember the groups now. I remember speaking before them. There was a group out in Grand Blanc that wanted to hear all of the candidates. I went to Grand Rapids, Michigan to appear on a television program, and I spoke over radio. And this, again, was something that my heart really wasn't in it as much as the other kind of work. I'm more of a broad organization person. I work best that way. But I did. I followed out and did the job because I was the best known.
The president of the party,
yeah.
To learn someone, since you were the most visible, yeah. And best known and respected,
yes.
The whole conflict,
yes.
And all of that, you were selected.
Yes, yes. They didn't have anybody else who could... you know, had the reputation that I had, because...
Did you ever feel, you know, that you were used or didn't like doing that? I mean, that since what you liked was kind of like this other kind of organizing, but that you were the name that could draw people. How did you feel about that?
Well, I never said very much about it, sure enough. I hated being used by men in the movement very often. For jobs which they could not do, and they very often acted as though I was a puppet of theirs. They were the big political leaders. I resented that, but I was far too busy to take up issues like that, except, oh, I was a maverick in the party. My God, they were going to expel me more than once. But, and I really, well, I knew that I was used, but I knew, also that in the NAACP, you have to use the person that's the best for the job. I didn't resent doing it if I felt that it was going to bring across the message. But by this time, on one of the campaigns, I got to the position where I felt that I didn't think it was exactly fruitful. A Labor Party, I would come in there as a socialist and say, yes, I'm a socialist, but I'm working in the mass movement. I would have been much, much happier doing that. But I did it.
So there was, you had some feeling.
I wasn't thrilled about it.
About, you would prefer having worked in broader base.
Yes, I was, that's more my.
You were involved in the party.
Mm-hmm.
Your heart was in these other broader base activities.
Right. And I always felt it was the party's job to educate in the mass movement.